that more than 60% of the problems that designers faced had already been solved by another team. It's very likely that any large-scale or manufacturing company with manual processes in place would find a similar amount of overlapping or repeated work. To ensure that designers began to build on previous work instead of starting over each time, Yu's organization created a database of best-known methods for addressing technical problems and used a browser interface to ensure access from its half-dozen different design sites. Intel also developed software tools to help verify the correctness of a circuit design up front and to track manufacturing defects and identify problems in the manufacturing process. Together, the software tools involved in the D2000 program have helped Intel to almost double the speed at which it has ramped up new product production since 1994. Intel is well on its way to meeting the D2000 goal of achieving volume production from the first design of a chip, rather than having to go through several iterations of a design to perfect it. Technology-driven shortening of time to market affects more than just manufacturing or high-tech industries. In book publishing, information tools have cut the cycle time from manuscript to publication in half, from 18 months to 9 months. This book went from final manuscript to publication in less than 5 months. Making first a corporate mantra. Although banks have always been big users of information technology, as regulated businesses, they have not had a reputation for innovation or for rapid time to market with new programs or services. Banco Bradesco, with 20 million customers, the largest bank in Brazil, is a notable exception. Almost since its inception, this banking company has made time to market practically a mantra. With nearly 2,200 branches, Banco Bradesco has $68.7 billion in assets and serves 3 million people per day. Banco Bradesco was the first private Brazilian company to use computers in 1962, and it was the first bank to offer automated teller machines and home banking in 1982. The history of inflation in Brazil forced banks there to keep account information up to date all the time. Even today, banks in the United States and most other countries do not keep account information as current as Brazil banks do. Bradesco is sometimes called the bank to beat in Brazil because it uses technology to develop innovative solutions for customers faster than its competitors. Bradesco provides its customers not just traditional banking services, but any services related to finance, all in the name of keeping the loyalty of its customers. To stay ahead of the competition, even 6 months is too long to bring a new idea to the market, so Bradesco focuses on short development cycles, weeks and months, no longer. The bank also wants to take a new product or service to its entire customer base at the same time, so it plans rollout logistics carefully. For one small business customer, Bradesco developed a cash management software application to assist with payables and receivables. Now, about 4,100 businesses are using the application. For another customer, Bradesco developed a salary card that enabled employees to be paid directly from Bradesco ATM machines without being required to have a bank account. The card is now in use at about 1,300 companies, quickly expanding to 2,000 companies and 1 million employees. In each case, Bradesco was the first bank to offer such a service. In 1996, Banco Bradesco became the first Brazilian financial institution, and only the fifth in the world, to use the Internet to offer banking services. In the summer of 1998, it became the first bank in the world to provide online banking for people with visual disabilities. A speech synthesizer reads aloud the content of the web page to the user. By 1998, 350,000 of its 440,000 online customers were banking over the Internet instead of over the original proprietary dial-up service, and the number of Internet customers was growing at 12% per month. Online banking has caught on in Brazil faster than in any other country. Access to a full range of financial services is offered through the bank's website, BradescoNet. In addition to the usual banking services, Bradesco also offers 10 investment vehicles, including mutual funds, via the Internet, and it's joining many of its partners to develop web stores accessible through BradescoNet or through a partner's own site. Each partner company, 20 and growing as of late 1998, provides a catalog of products, and the bank does everything else. Customers select the products they want to buy as they would at any online store. The difference is that payment is made through an immediate funds transfer from the customer's bank account to the partner's bank account. Because of this direct connection with the customer's bank account, the shopper doesn't have to provide a credit card number online. ProdescoNet enables consumers to buy anything from chocolates to cell phones, pay their phone and utility bills, and even pay government taxes, such as motor vehicle fees. An example of Bradesco's desire to be first to market was its entry into Internet banking when most people saw the Internet as an amusement park. While other banks were worried that the Internet would displace them, Bradesco plowed ahead. We often hear complaints from companies, especially in the financial services industry, that technology empowers non-financial vendors to bypass them and offers direct services to their customers, says Alcino Rodriguez de Asunção. We don't buy that. At Banco Bradesco, we have taken a proactive stand. Technology threatens us if we sit back and let someone else use it. It helps us if we use it to move quickly to design services where the bank becomes the value-added intermediary to our customers. By being the first major commercial Internet site in Brazil, BradescoNet has the opportunity to become a portal site, the primary way Brazilian consumers will access the Internet. What better way to keep customer loyalty? Yet the bank recognizes that it needs to use its digital nervous system even better in the future. Today, Bradesco collects a lot of information about customers independently through its separate services such as savings, credit cards, loans, insurance, and so on. The bank's goal is to collect information across all of these transaction types to create a complete profile of the bank customer. By targeting its customers demographically, the bank can offer more focused services or cross-sell the new services its technology enables it to develop so quickly. By identifying automobile insurance payments, for example, the bank could also offer automobile loans to customers who finance their vehicle elsewhere. For customers with great payment records across a range of transactions, the bank might do special promotions whenever they have any new offerings, such as low-interest mortgage loans. This historical customer data is one of the bank's most valuable assets. Every financial transaction is already stored. It's up to the bank to devise the systems to best utilize that data as knowledge. The bank, which originally built its infrastructure around vertical applications, plans to take a horizontal view across departmental boundaries in order to better understand its customers as overall users of all bank services. It will take Bradesco several years to pull together all of this customer information, but then the bank will be able to rapidly devise and deliver still more customized services. Conquering cycle time. Probably nowhere has the product cycle shrunk more than in the PC industry, and the changes caused by a shrinking time to market are an indication of how other industries will also be affected. In this situation, a better flow of digital information does not simply make things better, but rather is a requirement for success. In just a few years, the product cycle for compact computer dropped from 18 months to 12 months. By late 1998, it dropped to 6 to 9 months for business products and to 4 months for consumer products. But with its older information systems, Compaq required 45 days to roll up its worldwide sales information into a single set of numbers that it could use to complete its product planning. By the time it could communicate its manufacturing needs to suppliers, the company would be halfway through the 4-month life cycle for important products. In an industry in which cycle time is king, the company had to have dynamic planning to remain competitive. Compaq implemented an Enterprise Resource Planning, ERP, system using SAP software as the base. In manufacturing, a good ERP system tracks the way the enterprise is operating each day and gives business managers the ability to control the way the manufacturing system responds. ERP at Compaq enhances its ability to accurately schedule production, fully utilize capacity, reduce inventory, and meet shipping dates. Compaq started the ERP project several years ago when it had different financial and planning systems, geographies, and factories around the world. Compaq now has all of its factories on SAP, including the factory that came with the acquisition of Tandem and 39 of Compaq's 46 sales subsidiaries worldwide. In parallel, Compaq has implemented a planning system for production that consolidates supply, demand, and manufacturing capacity into one data warehouse, sourced primarily from SAP. This consolidation gives Compaq worldwide consistency of all data needed to plan sales and manufacturing. As Compaq has consolidated systems, it has shrunk its 45-day planning cycle to a weekly planning cycle. Generally, a week's worth of sales information is necessary to get a real snapshot of the market for long-range sales planning. Compaq continues, though, to drive down its manufacturing cycle. It is now approaching daily pull capability to schedule materials from suppliers. Soon, it will drop to a shift-oriented, 8-hour pull schedule, and ultimately to a 4-hour pull schedule. While shortening its regular planning cycle, Compaq is also implementing real-time systems to enable it to react to unplanned changes in demand. Using the same data sources, the company wants to take a separate snapshot 3 times a night, 8 hours apart, at midnight, respectively, for the United States, Europe, and Asia, of information about its supply capability and committed order position. With real-time data instead of week-old or day-old data, Compaq wants to be able to see and react to, say, an unplanned order for 7,000 desktops, and work with suppliers to determine instantly whether the company can get all the critical parts and deliver on the order. To develop this kind of corporate reflex, Compaq is moving its existing electronic data interchange, EDI, systems to the Internet, using Internet protocols and standards. Where the complexity of the EDI system limits response to a weekly interval, an Internet-based e-commerce solution offers the company the ability to develop an event-based, real-time response with partners. When an order comes in, the supplier can see the new demand on the extranet at the same time as the Compaq planner. John White, who was CIO at Compaq for more than 4 years through 1998, likens Compaq's installation of its ERP system to changing out the wings and engines of a jet in flight. You have to keep the enterprise running even as you install the new systems. John White, who was CIO at Compaq for more than 4 years through 1998, likens Compaq's installation of its ERP system to changing out the wings and engines of a jet in flight. You have to keep the enterprise running even as you install the new systems. While Compaq was making the transition, the company's revenues grew from $7 billion to $35 billion, and it absorbed Digital Equipment Corporation, which had just begun its own conversion to SAP with a slightly different approach. White recommends that a manufacturing company put in the entire ERP package in one area, which could be by sales geography or sales subsidiary or by factory. Put in the complete portfolio once, rather than disrupt an organization repeatedly to install purchasing, financing, manufacturing, and planning one by one. A company can take one of two approaches to ERP. One, buying all the software modules from one vendor, gives you the benefits of integration. The other approach is to buy each module from the vendor with the best product, the best-of-breed tack. In the current wave of adoptions, the ease of integration has led a lot of manufacturing companies to go with a single vendor for ERP. As more standards evolve to represent business information in a formal way, the use of different packages will become more feasible. Another consideration is how much customization you do to the ERP system. Some packages let you customize in such a way that, as their new updates come along, your customized work will still function. In other cases, you'll be constantly reworking your code to adapt to their new version. It's part of the revolution in component software, discussed in the appendix, to make it easier to separate and maintain your customized modules without having to spend a lot every time a new version of the ERP system comes out. Both these areas, an easy exchange of data between packages and the preservation of customizations across versions, represent state-of-the-art work between applications vendors and Microsoft. Together, we're pushing forward standards in each industry to ensure that companies can make the most of their large ERP and related investments. Increasing power and decreasing time. Greater computing power is a requirement to meet Compaq's goals of real-time execution. On the old mini-computer systems, it took 8 to 10 hours to run a planning cycle. Using its own high-end PC systems, Compaq has gotten the time down to 25 minutes. But to obtain instant response to unexpected customer demands, Compaq requires memory-resident, real-time databases. New 64-bit PC server software provides this capability, enabling Compaq to represent in memory the largest possible business problem it could calculate through any combination of 8,000 part numbers, 46 sales geographies, 6 major manufacturing facilities, and 12 distribution centers. These new capabilities are good examples of how technology and business are intertwined, and how technology enables new processes. Without powerful processors and digital information flow, it would simply not be possible for Compaq to shorten its business cycles. If it takes 8 to 10 hours to crank the numbers, and you can't update or access the database during that time, how can your information systems be as responsive as you need in an era of just-in-time delivery? Publish and subscribe technology is another critical component for Compaq's future. It's the bridge between ERP and the planning systems. Publish and subscribe enables the company to extract data in a way that is reliable and near real time. As soon as changes are confirmed to the order or inventory position, the data system publishes the changes to a network server, which then pushes the information automatically to the PCs of the business people who have signed up for notification. The technology gives Compaq the ability to replicate information to the people who need it, while avoiding big loads on the central database. Going further, publish and subscribe technology can generate events on the workstations of everybody involved in a business area, including suppliers on the extranet. The Compaq buyer and supplier won't have to constantly monitor the extranet site to keep an eye open for any changes. If that order for 7,000 computers comes in, both buyer and supplier will get a real-time alert on their PCs. Shrinking time to market even further. Digital processes make it possible for every business to dramatically shorten its time to market, although some amount of time and energy will always be required to deliver physical goods. MIT's Nicholas Negroponte describes the difference between physical products and information products in the digital age as the difference between moving atoms around, physical products such as cars and computers, and moving bits around, electronic products such as financial analyses and news broadcasts. Producers of atoms still can't beam the physical objects through space, but they can use bit speed, digital coordination of all kinds, to bring reaction time down dramatically. Almost all the time involved in producing an item is in the coordination of the work, not in the actual production. The British government did a study and found out that it required almost a year to take aluminum ore from the ground and deliver it as a can on the grocery shelf. Almost all of that time spent waiting between steps in paper-based processes. Good information systems can remove most of that waiting time, and makers of physical products will find that online service, another bid-oriented as opposed to atom-oriented effort, will become as much a part of the product and customer experience as the physical goods they deliver. The speed of delivery and the interaction with the customer made possible by the Internet effectively shifts products into services. Product companies today need to compare themselves not with the best of their competitors, but with the best of all service companies. Product companies need to ensure that their corporate cultures and their infrastructures support fast research, analysis, collaboration, and execution. And they need to treat their websites not as nifty add-ons, but as integral parts of product development and refinement. Ultimately, the most important speed issue for companies is cultural. It's changing the perceptions within a company about the rapidity with which everybody has to move. Everybody must realize that if you don't meet customer demand quickly enough, without sacrificing quality, a competitor will. Once the mindset adapts to the need for action, digital technology enables fast reflexes. Business lessons. Time to market is shrinking for every business, whether it sells physical or information products. Using digital information to be first to market can radically improve your competitive position. The most important speed issue is often not technical, but cultural. It's convincing everyone that the company's survival depends on everyone moving as fast as possible. Moving to an enterprise resource planning package will help you instill the rigor and standardization you need in your financial data. Diagnosing your digital nervous system. Do you use digital data flow to achieve faster turnaround, higher quality, and lower prices? Do you have electronic links among manufacturers, suppliers, sales, and other functions so that planning cycles are compressed? Do you have digital systems that enable you to react to production changes within the same 8-hour work shift? Part 3. Manage knowledge to improve strategic thought. Chapter 10. Bad news must travel fast. The high-performance corporations are different. They worry about failure a lot. It makes them pay close attention to what is going on in their market. Guillermo G. Marmol, McKinsey & Company. I have a natural instinct for hunting down grim news. If it's out there, I want to know about it. The people who work for me have figured this out. Sometimes I get an email that begins, "In keeping with the dictum that bad news should travel faster than good news, here's a gem." A lot goes wrong in any organization, even a good one. A product flops. You're surprised by a customer's sudden defection to another vendor. A competitor comes out with a product that appeals to a broad new market. Losing market share is the kind of bad news that every organization can relate to. Other bad news may have to do with what's going on internally. Maybe a product is going to be late, or it's not going to do what you expected it to do, or you haven't been able to hire enough of the right kinds of people to deliver on your plans. An essential quality of a good manager is a determination to deal with any kind of bad news head-on, to seek it out rather than deny it. An effective manager wants to hear about what's going wrong before he or she hears about what's going right. You can't react appropriately to disappointing news in any situation if it doesn't reach you soon enough. You focus on bad news in order to get cracking on the solution. As soon as you're aware of a problem, everybody in your organization has to be galvanized into action. You can evaluate a company by how quickly it engages all of its available intellect to deal with a serious problem. An important measure of a company's digital nervous system is how quickly people in the company find out about bad news and respond to it. Digital technology speeds corporate reflexes in any emergency. In the old days, an organization's response to bad news was necessarily slow. Business leaders often learned about problems only after they became serious, since the only quick way to pass information was to interrupt them with a phone call. Before handling a problem, people had to dig up information in paper files or go down the hall to find somebody who knew something about the situation. Once the information was in hand, however late and incomplete, people conferred over the phone or faxed data to each other. Every step in the process was very time-consuming. There was no way to gather scattered anecdotal information to get a complete picture. Even with a combination of telephone and fax, it's hard to recognize a pattern of bad developments before it shows up in sales results. Even with mainframe computers sorting customer data in a centralized location, extracting information in a timely way is so hard that the stored data is seldom of much help in a crisis. Though the dawn of the information age means we can send information fast, most companies don't gather the key information about customer issues in one place. By contrast, a well-designed digital nervous system operates as an early warning system. Suspend disbelief, but not forever. Several years ago, Microsoft was one of a handful of companies investing heavily in interactive television in the expectation that the market would develop quickly. We were working with Telecommunications Incorporated, TCI, and Southwestern Bell, and in late 1995 had a pilot project in Tokyo with Nippon Telephone and Telegraph. As we proceeded, there was a slow realization that the costs were higher and the customer benefits lower than we all had assumed they would be. Interactive television wasn't going to come together as soon as we expected, or in the way we expected. But why did it take so long for all of us to figure this out? The simple answer is that human nature made us reluctant to evaluate the bad news. The world was taking too long to move from analog to digital television. Costs had not come down enough, and there weren't enough new applications to keep network providers enthusiastic about building out the infrastructure. Yet we didn't acknowledge these obstacles, or didn't want to admit they were there. You have to be able to make risky assumptions to undertake a new venture. To a certain extent, you have to suspend your disbelief and say, "Hey, we're going to go for this new business. Let's do our best." But every once in a while, you also need to reassess the key assumptions to decide whether there will be a timely market for your new product or service. It's a thankless job. Would you want to be the one to call the meeting to say that the whole thing's too far off to be worth investing in? In retrospect, there were serious doubts among the members of our interactive TV group about our progress and direction. Among other indicators, the number of people who transferred out of the group makes it clear that at least a few people knew we were off track. Ultimately, Craig Mundy, the division's senior vice president, called the bad news meeting. We decided to move some technology associated with the interactive TV project, such as cryptography and multimedia software, into products we could ship to the business market. Craig kept responsibility for small form factors and our Windows CE product. We retained a small core group to continue to work on our consumer TV efforts, basically to dig in and wait for digital TV to arrive, which happened 2 years later. To get into a new business, you have to believe, at least for a while, but you also have to be alert to bad news, and you have to be agile enough to adapt if the opportunity morphs into something new. Conquering the world and going out of business. The Internet was not always the top priority in Microsoft's strategy. Its arrival changed our business and became the biggest unplanned event we've ever had to respond to. In fact, in 1995, various experts predicted that the Internet would put Microsoft out of business. This was bad news on a colossal scale. We used our digital nervous system to respond to that crisis. On August 24, 1995, we introduced Windows 95, the most ambitious software product to reach out to the general consumer, with the biggest fanfare in computer history. The print news coverage was immense, hundreds of articles in the months leading up to the launch. We were described as invincible as we pulled away from our competitors on the desktop. Windows Magazine said, "This year, for better or worse, Microsoft wins the war." A Time Magazine editorial said that Microsoft was the gravitational center of the computer universe. The introduction of Windows 95 itself made major TV newscasts. Within a couple of months, though, the press coverage cascaded in the other direction. The Internet had burst into the public's awareness, and the perception was that Microsoft hadn't been invited to the new party. Now stories in the press said that we didn't get it. The Internet signified our doom. Small, nimble competitors would put Microsoft out of business. Risk Sherland, an analyst with Goldman Sachs and Company and a longtime Microsoft specialist, generated headlines when, in mid-November, he downgraded our stock because we didn't have a compelling Internet strategy. Paul Saffo, a researcher at the Institute for the Future, a think tank in Menlo Park, California, summed up the views of many observers when he said, "The tide has turned against everything Microsoft has built." By late fall, the Internet phenomenon had eclipsed Windows 95 as the industry's story of the year. On December 7, 1995, we held our first Internet Strategy Day, where for the first time we publicly previewed the array of technologies we were developing to integrate Internet support into our core products. Within a year of those announcements, we had Internet-enabled our major products and delivered a number of new ones focused on the Internet. Now we lead in several major Internet areas and have a growing share of the widely watched browser space. No one company will dominate the Internet, but Microsoft has come back to play an important role. How, our customers and the press often ask me, did we turn the ship around so fast? First of all, we were never oblivious to the Internet as we might have seemed to outside observers. It wasn't as if somebody said Internet and we didn't know how to spell it. We had several Internet technologies on our list of things to do. Back in 1991, we'd hired Jay Allard, a specialist in Internet working, to ensure that we developed the right technologies for interoperability. Microsoft was a founding or early member of several Internet associations. By mid-1993, we'd built support for the basic Internet networking protocol into our Windows NT product, both server and desktop. By then, we were also well underway with developing our approach to an online service, which became MSN. We had an Internet site set up in a hallway of Building 2 to test our Internet connectivity. As a draw, so that we could test the compatibility of our Internet technologies with a range of outside systems, we made a minor upgrade to MS-DOS available on the site. Jay Allard would drag everyone, from a new product manager to Paul Meritz, our group vice president of platforms, to Building 2, to show off the activity and fire up people about the Internet's potential. In a 10-week period, customers downloaded twice as many copies of the MS-DOS upgrade from this site as from CompuServe, a level of activity that told us something big was brewing. But let's also be clear. In 1993, we were not focused on the Internet. It was a fifth or sixth priority. Our new Microsoft Internet site consisted of three machines on an 8-foot folding table in Jay Allard's hallway with handwritten instructions on how to connect to the Internet. The yellow network cable for the Internet tap, which Jay had wheedled from our corporate IT group, ran out of his office over his wall to the machine in the hall. Four power strips bridged the outlet from another person's office to power all the equipment on the table. Duct tape held all these cords in place. It wasn't long before a fire marshal showed up, intent on shutting down Microsoft's site as a fire hazard. A week's reprieve enabled Jay to transfer the machines to our corporate IT facility, where he began to transform our fledgling Internet support into a full-blown corporate program. At this time, we didn't have an overall internet strategy for the company. We didn't see that the internet, a network for academics and techies, would blossom into the global commercial network it is today. We were focused on broadband applications such as video conferencing and video on demand. The internet had such a limited capacity to carry digital information then that we saw it as a minor stop along the way. To our surprise, everything coalesced around the internet protocols as it achieved broad critical mass. The internet's sudden growth in popularity changed all the rules, and its growth kept accelerating. People were willing to put up with the internet's deficiencies because it made vast amounts of information available and enabled easy communication. Content providers raced to respond to the opportunity, creating a positive feedback loop and exponential growth. In 1993 alone, internet use doubled to more than 25 million people. The impetus for Microsoft's response to the internet didn't come from me or from our other senior executives. It came from a small number of dedicated employees who saw events unfolding. Through our electronic systems, they were able to rally everybody to their cause. Their story exemplifies our policy, from day one, that smart people anywhere in the company should have the power to drive an initiative. It's an obvious common-sense policy for information-age companies where all the knowledge workers should be part of setting the strategy. We could not pull off such a policy without the technology we use. In many ways, technology has shaped the policy. Do people all over my company feel free to send me email because we believe in a flat organization? Or do we have a flat organization because people have always been able to send email directly to me? For years, everybody at Microsoft has had a PC and email access. It's a famous part of our corporate culture, and it's shaped the way we think and act. The original Internet PC. The idea of an information empowerment tool is not a new one. It goes back to Dr. Vannevar Bush's Memex machine, described in 1945. Bush, director of the U.S. Office of Scientific Research and Development during World War II, predicted the development of a device in which you could store all your books, records, and communications and call up the data on a screen. This Memex could hold hundreds of years of material, including longhand notes, annotations, and photographs. Associative indexing would create and maintain links between items to make momentarily important information easier to find and correlate from the maze of data. Bush's Memex, a big physical desk and microfilm storage operated by physical levers, now conjures up an image of the Wizard of Oz manipulating a clumsy contraption behind the curtain. But his analysis of the problem, that our way of handling information was inadequate, and his solution, a device that stored and organized all our information, were both fundamentally correct. He described in the mechanistic terms of 1945 technology the multimedia PC connected to the web. He even predicted the equivalent of internet search engines establishing useful trails through the enormous mass of the common record. Technological advances transmuted Bush's vision, making it seem old-fashioned, even as it came true. Meeting physically and electronically. In true Microsoft fashion, Jay Allard, Steven Sinofsky, my technical assistant then, and a few other people were the instigators of our response to the rising popularity of the Internet. In January 1994, Jay wrote a memo in which he laid out the opportunities and dangers presented by the Internet. Coincidentally, within a week, Steve went to Cornell University on a recruiting trip. While stuck there for 2 days in a snowstorm, he checked out how the university was using computers. A 1987 graduate who had worked for the IT group at Cornell as a student, Steve was amazed at the revolutionary changes Cornell had undergone since his visit the year before. In his email trip report, Steve marveled at how wired the school was. About a third of the students had PCs, some school departments provided PCs, and kiosk PCs were available in public spaces. Email use by students was close to 100%. Many of Cornell's instructors were communicating with students online, and students were pestering their parents to get their own email accounts. A wide variety of information, including much of the Cornell library catalog, was available online. A student could view her current course schedule, her previous grades, her outstanding accounts, financial aid information, and a directory of the school community online. Many faculty members were communicating with students online and used online chat services to collaborate with each other. There was a huge movement to make all sorts of information available to students via the web. Steve even saw real-time video conferencing over the internet. What struck Steve was how thoroughly this technology had become integrated into campus life, in practically no calendar time, and how students took it totally for granted. He said that for students, the online services are as ubiquitous and expected as regular phone service, and that this pace of change in information access is faster than for any other technology I have seen in my lifetime, including the personal computer itself. Students were even complaining that they couldn't sign up for classes online. Jay and Steve made a number of recommendations about what Microsoft should do to participate in this revolution. Where Steve had focused on the users and cultural changes, Jay drilled into the technical implications for a variety of Microsoft products. He noted that we were behind many of our competitors as far as the internet was concerned, but said that our agility and creativity will allow us to catch up quickly, provided there was efficient communication between the groups within Microsoft that these efforts impact. Jay saw a lot of potential synergy among groups, although he also stressed the potential for disaster if we fail to coordinate our activities company-wide. He listed a wide range of Microsoft groups he thought needed to cooperate in an internet effort. Steve and Jay's memos quickly circulated by email among a large number of people at Microsoft. They set off a firestorm of electronic deliberation. The number of issues to be considered was huge. How should our operating systems support the internet? What did internet-ready or internet-enabled mean for Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel, and the rest of our productivity suite? What did it mean for our email products? What new products did we need? What internet technology should be packaged as new products, and what technology should be incorporated into our existing products? Which technology should we license? Should we focus initially on the ways businesses could use internet technologies internally, or on the ways consumers could use the technologies broadly? Sometimes an idea got quick agreement. Sometimes the response was shrill mail saying you've got it all wrong. At different times, people prodded me and other senior executives to move faster. We set up more taps to the internet so that people could use it and learn about it firsthand. We told middle managers to go out and explore the internet, to develop their own impressions, and come to their own conclusions about what had merit on the web and what didn't. We all had favorite sites we'd recommend to the others. Checking out competitor sites became something you did every morning. I still do. I have one PC in my office set up to rotate through a number of websites, including our competitors' sites, so that I can see how different companies are using the web to promote their products and interact with customers. These independent explorations led to dozens and dozens of great ideas. Quickly, over email, people offered their opinions, fleshed out the issues, considered the options. The amount of email was just fantastic. Email discussions led to many small group meetings, often loud, informal ones in the hallways, to hammer out recommendations. Hallways and email, that's how it happened. As topics expanded, smaller groups would break off into their own email chains to consider subsets. Before long, large numbers of people in different parts of our organization were participating. I was engaged in lengthy email exchanges with dozens of people involving everything from our business strategy for online services to our technical approach to hyperlinking. Keeping focused, acting fast. We kept our internet development plan and action items on our network so that it was visible to everybody who cared. Managers at all levels would check the list regularly and follow up. When work in an area seemed to be lagging, people would rally around to focus on it. To get a big company moving fast, especially on a many-headed opportunity like the internet, you have to have hundreds of people participating and coming up with ideas. But you've also got to get them focused, or you'll never get any decisions made or get anything done. Our digital nervous system informed and propelled our decision-making. Email generated the thinking and analysis, so teams moved quickly to develop strong points of view and recommendations. Once the email chains got long enough and we had enough issues and recommendations to consider, we'd go off on retreats to produce the final decisions. Then we'd set priorities and ensure coordination among major groups. In 1994, we had three classic retreats, several months apart. After the first one, on April 6, 1994, I emailed my staff to say, "We're going to make a big bet on the internet." I devoted my April 1994 Think Week to the internet and multimedia topics. In a Think Week, which I do twice a year, I set aside all other issues to concentrate on the most difficult technical and business problems facing the company. We held our first major progress review in August 1994. Once again, it was the newer employees running the show. Jay, who at that time was a program manager with no direct reports, led the meeting with assistance from Steve Sanofsky and other people who had expertise in important areas. As Jay put it, there were no titles in the presenter lineup, and they all felt it was like the kids entering the boardroom when the meeting began. One young guy went home before the meeting to change into Dockers and a button-down shirt to be more appropriate, only to discover that his associates and a few of the senior staff were attending in T-shirts and Birkenstocks. One of the biggest concerns at the time was whether we could convert our internal product and sales information from its database format into internet-readable HTML format. Much of the massive amount of product information was appropriate for customers, and we thought it would be a great addition to our website as we were getting off the ground. One person at the meeting felt that the technical challenges of conversion would be too difficult. The next speaker, the fellow who'd put on the spiffy clothes, turned out to have already developed a converter. It had been a Skunkworks project. His manager had told him the internet would never be part of their group's business. By the time of this meeting, the small team had already converted thousands of files containing product information into HTML, and many of these files were already beginning to go online. I was pleased to see so much initiative. By early 1995, months before we introduced Windows 95, every team at Microsoft had defined its internet charter and begun development. In short order, we were rolling out internet add-ons, internet integration, and new internet products. In a May 1995 email memo called The Internet Tidal Wave, I summarized our strategic directions and decisions and announced a corporate reorganization to map our internet goals to every segment of the company. I made certain that the entire company understood the importance of our focus on the internet. Developments on the internet over the next several years will set the course of our industry for a long time to come. The internet is the most important single development to come along since the IBM PC was introduced in 1981. Since the internet is changing so rapidly, we will have to revise our strategies from time to time and have better intergroup communication than ever before. Our products will not be the only things changing. The way we distribute information and software, as well as the way we communicate with and support customers, will be changing. By the time we went public with our internet strategy in December 1995, it was damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. As I've said several times since, if we go out of business, it won't be because we're not focused on the internet. It'll be because we're too focused on the internet. Making the difference through email. We reached most of the important decisions during this crisis in face-to-face talk, but our decisions were all informed well ahead by the exchanges taking place over email. Electronic collaboration is not a substitute for face-to-face meetings. It's a way to ensure that more work gets done ahead of time so that meetings in person will be more productive. Meeting time is so precious that you want to be sure you're dealing with facts and good recommendations based on solid analysis, not just anecdotal evidence. You want to be sure that meetings produce actionable decisions, that you don't just sit around speculating and talking about philosophical stuff. To be sure, our competitors in this space also use electronic tools. In the high-tech industry, email is considered old hat. We take it for granted, just as we do PCs. We take email so much for granted that at the end of 1996, when I predicted in my syndicated newspaper column that email would be used by a majority of companies by the end of 1997, a prediction that came true, two computer columnists gave me a hard time. Bill Gates predicts the past, was basically what they said. Those of us in the PC industry had been using email for 15 to 20 years, but these writers didn't realize that even in 1996, less than half the companies in the world used email. Having a critical mass of employees on email today is not enough, though. Unless all knowledge workers use email several times a day, companies will not get enough value from it to make it worthwhile. As a way of comparison, in a company where email is integral to the culture, the average person will send 5 to 10 messages a day and get 25 to 50. Heavy users will send or receive well over 100 messages a day. We in the PC industry sometimes forget that use of our own tools is one reason the whole industry has advanced so quickly. We can all move fast to see and respond to a customer problem or to what a competitor is doing. For a large company to be able to maneuver as well as or better than a smaller competitor, is a testament to both the energy of the employees and the use of digital systems. Personal initiative and responsibility are enhanced in an environment that fosters discussion. Email, a key component of our digital nervous system, does just that. It helps turn middle managers from information filters into doers. There's no doubt that email flattens the hierarchical structure of an organization. It encourages people to speak up. It encourages managers to listen. That's why when customers ask what's the first thing they can do to get more value out of their information systems and foster collaboration in their companies, I always answer email. Our corporate presence on the web was better, but... During the mid-1990s, we were not just building internet-related products. Like other companies, we were also learning to use the internet to promote our products and services. On the evening of November 2, 1995, I spent several hours browsing Microsoft's homepage on the World Wide Web, and then fired off an email to 13 senior executives whose groups had major amounts of content on the web. The subject was Microsoft Marketing on the Internet, and my main concerns were complex page designs, inconsistencies across different pages, and the overuse of big splashy graphics whose downloading slowed access to real information. Although I would say our corporate presence on the Internet is better, I still think it falls far short of what we need to do. It doesn't reflect our desire to show people we care about the Internet. Our corporate site is still very weak. We have huge bitmaps with a collage of colors. It's as though someone thinks the measure of a good web page is stepping back and looking at it after it downloads, instead of its information utility. We need someone with the mentality of a front-page editor who tries to put as much information onto a page as possible, instead of creating a labyrinth of pages that you go to that just make you go further. I pointed the senior executives to the Boston Globe site. They use small pictures in order to make things move at a decent speed. They always try and grab you with some extra text, not just a button name. You want to go down into the next level, unlike our stuff. Here are some of my specific reactions to a selection of Microsoft's pages. Look at how many clicks it takes to find your way to anything about Office that, A, is a promotion you should think about, or, B, encourages you to get the product because of what is in it. The best material is actually confusingly in a place called News Top Stories. That is the first place I found that really had some meat in it. Put a lot more on each page, some real meat about the products, some real news, some excitement about the offers. There is nothing that grabs you on the consumer pages. You wouldn't know that we just shipped some amazing products. You wouldn't know we actually get good reviews on our products. I couldn't even get the in-depth information I wanted. In this case, the bad news came directly from the boss, and it sank in. By the time of our Internet Strategy Day a month later, the worst of these problems had been fixed. Paying attention to bad news. Bad news can be really disheartening. When you get news of a product failure, there's a real temptation to think, oh, that's as much as I want to know about that. I think I'll go home now. I think I'll work on something else. When you lose a customer, it can be tempting to tell each other, that customer's not very sharp. They just made the wrong decision. Meetings in which colleagues try to explain away a product failure or a lost customer are the worst, but they are preferable to the meeting that isn't called, to the silence and inactivity when nobody tells you something negative is going on. If a competitor introduces a superior product, or if you lose a customer, resist the temptation to put it out of mind. Ignoring bad news is a formula for decline. Only the paranoid survive, is Intel chairman Andrew Grove's book about the need for a business to stay alert to change at what he calls major inflection points in the market. In the book, Andy talks about how important it is for a company's middle managers, often the first to realize that what worked before doesn't quite work anymore, to confront senior management with bad news. Otherwise, he says, senior management in a company is sometimes late to realize that the world is changing on them, and the leader is often the last of all to know. In one example of a major inflection point, Andy describes Intel's slow response to a crisis over early versions of its Pentium chip in late 1994. Certain chips contained a minor engineering flaw. Intel reacted to the problem on the basis of it being a relatively insignificant bug that would affect only a very small number of users. Customers, however, felt differently. Highly technical users cared about minor computational errors. The general consumers, Intel was now quoting, were alarmed at the mere suggestion that something could be wrong with their PCs. Intel endured unrelenting bombardment, as Andy described it, much the result of customers rallying together on the Internet, before offering a free replacement part to anyone who wanted it. Few customers took the company up on its offer, but the public anger subsided immediately. An engineer himself, Andy confessed that he was one of the last to understand that his company now had to respond to a customer crisis as a consumer products company would, not in a month, as it had taken Intel this time, but in a matter of days. It took a barrage of relentless criticism to make me realize that something had changed and that we needed to adapt to the new environment. The lesson is, we all need to expose ourselves to the winds of change. We need to expose ourselves to our customers, both the ones who are staying with us as well as those that we may lose by sticking to the past. We need to expose ourselves to lower-level employees who, when encouraged, will tell us a lot that we need to know. Some experts say that companies struggle with the need for change because they haven't been designed for change. Hierarchy gets in the way. The corporate culture sees innovation as risky and suspect. Worthy failure, experimentation, is punished. A similar reaction can set it against bad news. Lower-level staff may hesitate to bring bad news forward, and many managers don't want to hear it. Corporate structure and culture can be a real roadblock, no question. A change in corporate attitude, encouraging and listening to bad news, has to come from the top. The CEO and the other senior executives have to insist on getting bad news, and they have to create an appetite for bad news throughout their organizations. The bearer of bad tidings should be rewarded, not punished. Business leaders have to want to listen to alerts from salespeople, product developers, and customers. You can't just turn off the alarm and go back to sleep, not if you want your company to survive. Most of the excellent computer companies that Tom Peters and Robert Waterman cited back in 1982 in their fine book, In Search of Excellence, have experienced serious setbacks since the book came out. IBM saw both its mainframe and its mini-computer businesses undermined by PCs in the 1980s and 1990s. Digital Equipment Corporation undercut IBM's mainframes with its smaller mini-computers, only to be undercut itself later by the still smaller PCs that Digital and many other computer companies had dismissed as toys. Wang didn't see the PC revolution coming either and lost the word processing market to companies that provided software on the PC rather than on dedicated hardware systems. These companies still talked to their customers. They still had smart, responsive people working for them. IBM's own Skunkworks team had released the IBM PC in 1981, establishing a standard that made the PC a business tool. But IBM continued for two full decades to see PCs through the lens of its larger computer systems. This view distorted and slowed its response to a fundamental technology shift. After allowing Compaq to get out of the gate first with a 32-bit PC system, IBM watched its share of the PC market drop from 55% to 15% within a couple of years. Its share now hovers below 10%. Digital, despite a reputation for high-quality products and services, struggled throughout the PC era until Compaq, a PC vendor, bought it in 1998. Wang went through bankruptcy before emerging again as a systems integrator. Examples from the computer industry are only the most recent instances of an unwillingness to hear bad news. In 1920, Ford had 90% of the low-priced car market and was responsible for 54% of the total automotive manufacturing output in the country. Ford's position seemed to be invincible. Yet by May 1927, technical advances at General Motors and other automotive companies had forced Henry Ford to take the drastic step of shutting down his main plant for an entire year to retool for new designs. Today, Ford is still a world leader in automobile production and quality, but it has never regained its pre-1927 position in the industry. Somebody at Ford saw the changes coming in the 1920s. An engineer who came up with a new design was fired for his temerity. The senior leadership wouldn't listen. In commercial aviation, Douglas Aircraft, with its DC series, had a major lead over Boeing immediately after World War II. Douglas was so focused on filling all of its orders for the propeller-powered DC-7 that it failed to move quickly enough to jet engines. Boeing built the jet-powered 707 on speculation, without a single customer order in hand, and never looked back. Douglas is now part of Boeing. An unwillingness to hear bad news and take action isn't just a business phenomenon either. History is full of far more serious examples. Many books have been written about why the United States was not prepared for the attack on Pearl Harbor that hurled the country into World War II. According to historian Gordon Prang, the American military could not overcome its psychological unpreparedness. Communication of the bad news of potential war was flawed, too. Cable after cable warned U.S. admirals and generals in the Pacific of the imminent likelihood of war, yet cryptic cables made for confusing orders to the forces in Hawaii. In the last 24 hours, lower-level officers with tantalizing clues to the time and place of the attack scurried around, hand-carrying paper folders up through the chain of command. No one could bring together all of the pieces of information until it was too late. It doesn't do any good to be receptive to bad news if you can't get bad news up through your organization and then do something about it in a hurry. Today's digital technology can ensure that you get the news and that you put your organization into action fast. Acting on bad news. How fast a company can respond in an emergency is a measure of its corporate reflexes. People in the organization will feel lousy and threatened by bad news, but that's okay as long as they feel it as a group. As an act of leadership, I created a sense of crisis about the Internet in 1994 and 1995, not to leave people paralyzed or unhappy, but to excite them to action. The leader needs to create an environment in which people can analyze the situation and develop a good response. I like good news as much as the next person, but it also puts me in a skeptical frame of mind. I wonder what bad news I'm not hearing. When somebody sends me an email about an account we've won, I always think, there are a lot of accounts nobody has sent mail about. Does that mean we've lost all of those? This reaction may seem unwarranted, but I found there's a psychological impulse in people to send good news when there's bad news brewing. It's as if they want to lessen the shock. A good email system ensures that bad news can travel fast, but your people have to be willing to send you the news. You have to be consistently receptive to bad news, and then you have to act on it. Sometimes I think my most important job as a CEO is to listen for bad news. If you don't act on it, your people will eventually stop bringing bad news to your attention, and that's the beginning of the end. In 3 years, every product my company makes will be obsolete. The only question is whether we'll make them obsolete or somebody else will. In the next 10 years, if Microsoft remains a leader, we'll have had to weather at least 3 major crises. That's why we've always got to do better. Ask anybody who's ever worked at Microsoft, and they'll tell you that if there's one cultural quality we have, it's that we always see ourselves as an underdog. I see us as an underdog today, just as I've seen us as an underdog every day for the last 20 years. If we don't maintain that perspective, some competitor will eat our lunch. I insist that we stay on top of the news, as well as pursue longer-term developments on the research front, and that we use bad news to drive us to put innovative new features into our products. One day somebody will catch us napping. One day an eager upstart will put Microsoft out of business. I just hope it's 50 years from now, not 2 or 5. Business lessons. A company's ability to respond to unplanned events, good or bad, is a prime indicator of its ability to compete. Strategically, a major function of the CEO is to look for bad news and encourage the organization to respond to it. Employees must be encouraged to share bad news as much as good news. The flatter the corporate hierarchy, the more likely it is that employees will communicate bad news and act upon it. Personal initiative and responsibility thrive in an environment that fosters discussion. Reward worthy failure, experimentation. Diagnosing your digital nervous system. Do your digital systems enable you to learn about bad news anywhere in the company and communicate it quickly? Do your digital systems enable you to assemble the necessary data and get teams working on solutions quickly? Can you put together virtual teams from separate departments and geographies? Chapter 11. Convert bad news to good. Outstanding service firms differentiate themselves on the basis of quality dimensions that are important to their customers and that explicitly or implicitly guarantee results. James Heskett, W. Earl Sasser, and Christopher W. Hart. Service breakthroughs. Once you embrace unpleasant news, not as a negative, but as evidence of a need for change, you aren't defeated by it. You're learning from it. It's all in how you approach failures. And believe me, we know a lot about failures at Microsoft. Back in the 1980s, our multi-plan spreadsheet product couldn't make any headway against Lotus 1-2-3. We spent the last half of the 1980s working on a database called Omega before we finally abandoned the project in 1990. We based our long-term operating system strategy on jointly building OS 2 with IBM, but that project came to an end in 1992 after we'd sunk hundreds of millions of dollars and countless hours of developer time into it. In the early 1990s, we had to can our Newton-like personal digital assistant because the technology wasn't good enough. In 1993, we had a project we thought would revolutionize office machines, such as copiers and faxes, called Microsoft at Work, but it never worked. In the mid-1990s, our TV-style internet shows on MSN were a flop. The weight of all of our failures could make me too depressed to come into work. Instead, I am excited about the challenges and by how we can use today's bad news to help solve tomorrow's problems. What we learned in our multi-plan spreadsheet effort helped us develop Microsoft Excel, the most advanced graphical spreadsheet when it came to market in 1985, and it still leads the competition. A lot of what we learned from the Omega database project paid off several years later when we shipped Microsoft Access, which became the most popular desktop database. That modern, built-from-scratch, world-class operating system, initially intended to be OS 2 version 3.0, became Windows NT instead. Our early experiences with small devices and office form factors helped us understand the technical requirements for a growing market we now serve with our Windows CE operating system. And our internet media investments taught us that our customers thought our role on the internet should be as a provider of practical, software-intensive products.